Marmalade and Loving Things, my favourite Marmalade track, that is. I've got to be honest with you. It's one of the first ones I heard, believe it or not. I had an album called Top of the Pops, a Hallmark album. It wasn't even Marmalade's version, but I loved the song. And then went and bought the proper single. I'm not that old, though. I'm honestly not that old. And on the phone from Marmalade is Alan Whitehead. Alan, how are you?
I'm good. Bored, but good.
Oh, I know it is. When I'm at home, when I'm not on the radio, it is just boring. There's the television just. I'm bored with looking at it.
I don't really watch much TV. I've cut the grass. I've messed around with my koi pond. I'm setting up the jacuzzi. I've cleaned the cars, and I'm bored now.
Oh, dear. Well, I've only got a little garden. There's not a lot we could do with it because the Doberman has completely obliterated the garden. So, and unless a garden centre opens up, there's nothing I can do to put it right. So, all I can do is come in and broadcast on the radio.
But, yeah, I guess what I've got to do, because I'm now working as a film producer, the company sent me loads of scripts to read, so...
Oh, wow.
I've got about 5 scripts to wade through. So that will keep me occupied. And I have to do a report on them because we get scripts and you read them and you look on whether it's viable and whether the story's interesting, whether the characters are good.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to invest money in a film, then the first step is obviously a good script.
Well, of course, you've got to, that is the baseball, as they say. That is the where you've got to go from an idea, a name, a script, and then off you go. You're away. How long have you been a film producer?
Well, what happened was when I stopped playing with Marmalade in 1978.
Yeah,
I switched into music management.
Oh wow!
And it was we had a really good run, and then I noticed it about 7 or 8 years ago. I think the final nail in the coffin after PWL was the X Factor. That whatever was left of the industry was destroyed, and there is no music industry anymore. I mean, any young artist think they're going to get a record deal? Well, pigs will fly before that happens. There are no record deals. There are no deals.
Do you know what? It's refreshing to hear somebody say that, because that is how it is out there.
Yeah, that's just how there are no deals. You can, and the thing that I noticed, this is not a criticism, every one of the managers and friends I have, agents, they were doing what they did 10 years ago.
Yep.
So they were still, but they're trying to do something that doesn't exist. I once read a great book, and it was written by a Canadian psychologist, and people think, well, I'll try harder. And he said, try harder, get more of the same, try differently. So about 4 years, about 3 years ago, I think it was, my best friend who I helped, he was made bankrupt 12 years ago, and I helped him. All of his friends deserted him. He's now worth, you've got to get your head around this, $200 million he's worth.
Wow.
And he said to me, do you want some money for your music management thing? And I said, well, there is no music management. You could spend 200 grand, 500 grand. It wouldn't make any difference at all.
Yeah.
But I've got a friend who's got a film company, because I did with the company Rock and Roll Cars, which is actually out. It's been sold worldwide. So I got to drive all these fabulous cars and interviewed people.
Nice.
And she'd written a really great script. So he mostly lives in Spain because he's a tax exile. anyway, we flew over and... I said, just give him the bullet points. He's not, don't be airy-fairy, he doesn't care. He wants to know what he's exposed for and how much he could make.
Yeah.
She did, and the end result was we financed the first film, which is called Lost, the Loss Adjuster, which stars Joan Collins, Luke Goss, Martin Kemp, Kim Marsh, and because I'd arranged the finance, you then become... That's what an executive producer is.
Right.
Executive producer, you've got all the fun with none of the responsibility. My responsibility is to make sure that the film was brought in under the budgets that were agreed with my friend, which we've done. It's a company called Pink Flamingo Films, and I've really enjoyed it because now I've been on set and I've seen, you can't look at a film again different. You don't look at a film now when you've seen it, how it's made.
Oh, yeah.
I've now got a different perspective on films. But, I mean, working with Luke, for people who remember, he was with Bross. I mean, what a lovely guy. We've become really good friends because he's a drummer like me.
He comes across as a nice guy.
He is just the nicest guy you could hope to meet.
Oh, wow.
And he's invited me to... he's really into meditating, and he goes out into the desert and spends days on his own, and he's invited me to join him. And I'm into meditation, so I said, would love to. He sleeps in old Indian teepees, and it's really my cup of tea. But obviously, it's trying to fit it in because he's got a very heavy film. Luke is a very busy actor. I think he's in Romania, or he was going to film in Romania, but that might be now delayed due to the virus.
Of course, I think he's put a kibosh on everything.
Yeah, so that's all I've done. And obviously, also, all films need music. So we are, any artist that we're looking now for, artists that can write their own music, because films need music. But if for all those young artists that think that there's a record deal at the end of the rainbow, sorry to tell you, there is no record deals anymore.
No,
there are none.
No.
I realized it because I went out to go every year to Music Expo in Los Angeles, and that is the hub of the industry, obviously LA.
Well, of course.
And I realized 5 years ago I was out there with, was managing Kayo Hendricks, Jimmy's daughter.
Yeah.
Because I knew Jimmy when he was alive, and his daughter. Actually, I knew Jimmy better than his daughter did, because he died when she was 4. But anyway, we went over to America, and obviously Teo is like being with the Queen. I mean, everyone wanted to meet her because they couldn't meet Jimmy, so they met
the closest
daughter,
thing, yeah.
But I realized none of the record companies were even remotely interested. They had these big showcases at a studio called SIR in West Hollywood.
Yeah.
And I noticed that none of the record companies even bothered going. They're just not interested.
That's terrible. I mean,
that's pretty tragic.
Back in the old days, let's go back to 1967, you joined the band, wasn't it?
Yeah, just when they changed their name from Dean Ford the Gaylords to Marmalade. They had to change their name because they were with CBS, and there was a group in America called the Gaylords, so they had to change their name.
Fair enough. How did Marmalade get a deal? How did Marmalade get found?
Well, they were the number one group in Scotland for 2 years running, and then John Salter had seen them on television. He started to get them gigs in the South.
Yeah.
And the original drummer didn't want to start again because that's what it meant. They had to relocate to London. So they advertised, and I got the gig. And about 3 months after I joined them, we'd done two support gigs. We supported Pink Floyd and a group called The Action, a really good group. They never made it, but they should have done, at the Marquee. And we then got a residency at the Marquee, and we were there for probably about 6 months every Thursday night. And it was at that time that we were with CBS, and I remember the Suits, we called them the Suits, they came down and they offered us Everlasting Love, and we wanted to do our own songs, so we turned it down.
That went to the Love Affair.
Yeah. And they came back a few months later and said, look, we've got this track, Loving Things, if you don't want to do it, we'll give it to Love Affair.
Right.
And we thought, the hell with it, let's record somebody else's song. And we did, and it was our first big hit in England. We'd had a hit with one of our own songs called I See the Rain, which my mate Graham Nash, Crosby, Stills and Nash, he was in the Hollies then, he produced it for me. And funny enough, Hendrix voted it as his favourite track of that year.
Wow.
If you hear it, you can hear it on YouTube. It is a very... We weren't influenced by Jimmy, but it's very Hendrix-y.
Yeah, Junior co-wrote that, didn't he?
Yeah, Junior and Dean, who, I don't know whether you're aware, Dean died a year ago. He had complications caused by Parkinson's.
Yeah,
Michael
died.
And he died on New Year's Day a year ago.
Oh, dear. That is terrible.
Yeah, we were all really cut up about it.
That is, it's horrible when you've known somebody for so long and that happens. It's just like losing a member of the family, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this is, I speak to Junior, who runs the affairs of the original Marmalade, because we own our own copyright.
Right.
So we license it.
Yeah.
But in fairness to the group, they were all, being Scottish, and I say this as a compliment, they were all heavy drinkers. They weren't interested in drugs, but boy, could they drink. And drink is just as damaging. I mean, they could drink a bottle of whiskey each day and it had no effect on them. But the damage it does to your main body organs.
Of course.
Whiskey in particular. And I wasn't a drinker. So I think I probably remained in... I mean, Pat is not very well. He lives in L.A. He's had throat cancer.
Right.
Me, Junior and Graham, we're still okay. But I'd say I probably have fared better, because I was never a heavy drinker. It, if you look at them, and Dean was an alcoholic for 15 years. So
wow.
When I saw him last in Los Angeles about 10 years ago, he looked frail. And that's the price you pay from being a heavy drinker, I think.
Oh, of course, without a doubt. So I'm going to have to go on Wikipedia and type in under your name that not only were you the drummer, you were the designated driver.
Well, I was, yeah. I mean, truthfully, most of them, I mean, although it didn't appear to be drunk, and you've got to bear in mind, in the last few years, which is one of the reasons why I just got married again, and my wife was very concerned. I mean, we were writing off cars like they were going out of fashion.
I bet.
And we stepped out of every car, God knows how. You've written cars off. One of them was driving and they'd been drinking. We were very lucky. I think there's that old saying, God protects fools and drunks, probably true.
Yes, it's very true. So anyway, you were telling me earlier, just before we came on air, about Loving Things, because we just mentioned Loving Things. Your first big hit got to number 6 in the UK. What were you going to tell me about it?
We were offered it by CBS, and if we hadn't have done that, they were getting edgy, because we've been with them 2 years and we hadn't had a hit.
Right.
In the old days, record companies would stick with you for a while. Now, it's a whole different ball game. But so we knew we had to have a hit. And Loving Things, in fairness, is a really good pop song.
Oh, it is.
Always was. That broke the band. And then we did Wake Me, Marianne, which wasn't so big. And then we found Obladi, and of course that... We didn't want to be a one-hit wonder, and Obladi really, even though it might be the worst single we ever made, because in fairness to it, it was a hit for anyone. It wouldn't matter who did that. It was a hit single.
Even John Lennon didn't like it.
I met Paul and talked. He was very upset with Dick James, because I think it was there was about 15 different versions of it.
Yeah.
But we had the hit, because CBS were the biggest, huge company, and they did a sale or return to all the shops, which meant if anyone came in and asked for Obladi, and they asked it by somebody else, they'd say, no, we've got the Marmalade one in. And in that time, you have to get your head around this, we were selling 75,000 singles a day.
Wow, that is a lot.
You wouldn't sell 75 in a week now, but 75,000 singles a day.
So
it rocketed to number one, and we only really went back to what I call the real Marmalade when we left CBS, joined Decca, and Decca gave it the freedom to write and produce our own material, and we did Reflections, which is by far the best and biggest hit we ever had. It was the number one in 18 countries. And it's the one that I'm the most proud of, because even though it's 50 years old, the lyrics and the music still, for me, sound as good as they did when we did it.
Oh, yeah. I played that earlier on. I played it in the other hour on the show. That's from 69. Did it only get to number 3 in this country, though?
Number one, as far as in some charts, number one.
Oh, right.
But we got more awards for that. I'm in my office now, and we've got awards on the wall. We've got more awards for that than any other thing we ever did.
So to jump in back...
And it's just a great... It's still a great track. It really suited Dean's voice, because Dean was... he was a very soulful, almost manic depressive, and that sadness in his voice is what makes, I think, a good soul singer.
You can
and
hear it in his voice singing that.
A melancholy in his voice that
yes.
really suits the track.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. Just jump me back to Obla Di Obla Da. How did you get that from...
Well, in the old days, what you would do, when you'd had a hit,
yeah.
you would then go around the publishers looking for a follow-up.
Right.
So we were traipsing around the publishers, and we went to Dick James, and he played us Obla Di.
Oh,
we,
Dick
we,
James
we,
had
we
it.
We knew it was
right.
a hit.
Right, I'm with you now, yes. Gotcha.
In fact, I don't know whether... When we recorded that, we were doing... There used to be a group of clubs, Mr. Smith's, and they were all... There was about 10 of them.
Yeah.
We were up in Newcastle. We chartered a small plane. We flew down... Recorded it overnight, and there is one subtle change. I was going to ask Paul if I could claim, you know, some royalties, but
what,
the Beatles version says if you want some fun right at the end,
that's it.
Sing Obla Di Obla Da. But if you listen to the Marmalades one,
you want some jam.
If you want some jam,
yeah,
that was my idea.
I got that joke.
Yeah, but I might have been the only one in the studio that was sober. Anyway, I can still hear when they're singing that. They were drunk. They used to drink, and
yeah.
I can still tell that they'd been drinking. So I knew the guy as well.
But it's a happy version. I mean, you can hear it. You can hear it. They're singing it like a party. That they're at a party doing it.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine that people asking what that era was like. It was wonderful because there were so many amazingly talented musicians.
Who, oh yeah,
they were almost like organic the way they grew. They weren't. We didn't have the social media that we do now, so the groups grew organically. But traveling around the world with a load of Glaswegians, because all the road crew were Glaswegian as well.
Wow.
And I can tell you one thing. Firstly, the Scottish are very clanny. And secondly, nobody wants to tangle with 10 Glaswegians.
No.
Nobody.
Nobody anywhere in the world. That's
No, and they weren't big guys, but once people sort of heard all those Glaswegian accents,
yeah.
Nobody wanted to mess with them. And also, the Scottish are really popular around the world. But the English, not so, so I used to keep quiet. Because the Scottish are liked and respected.
Yes. Yeah,
you notice that when you're travelling. The Scottish people have a very healthy respect and affection for them.
Yes.
I don't think the English are seen quite the same way.
No, it's something to do with attitude, I think, and it's an unfortunate thing, but nevertheless, that's what happens.
Yeah, I think I was known as the English Puff, as far as they were concerned. Yeah, if you're south of the border, you're a Puff, really. I mean, you're probably politically incorrect. I mean,
these days,
we hadn't had rum, you wouldn't get away with that now.
No. I'll tell you what, somebody did that once on another radio station. They were having a conversation with someone, and they used that word. And the Ofcom got a complaint about it. But that is, nowadays, you're talking about what happened in the 60s. It was different.
Yeah.
Did you tour with the Tremolos? I know you were label mates.
Well, the Tremolos were managed by our manager, Peter Walsh. So we did a lot of... We went to Israel with the Trems. We did a two-week tour just after the Six-Day War.
Wow.
We met Moshe Dayan. And
nice.
We went out and did gigs for the troops in the Sinai Desert.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Amazing. I mean, I've been everywhere. And the Trems, yeah, they were the group that we did more tours with. And like most drummers, I was friendly with Dave Munden, who's really unwell at the moment. He's had knees operation, and he can't walk, so we can't play anymore, which is tragic.
Well, that's a shame, because I gigged with them about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a bit more now. They did a thing called the Havering Show over in Hornchurch, and I used to compare it, and I worked with them and the Hollies that day. That was a nice afternoon for me.
Yeah, the Trems were all from down that area, Essex.
They were Essex boys. Yeah. Cause
and the Hollies, I mean, I'd say the Hollies were, when I saw them originally, in one of the best live bands I've ever seen. This is before in 1966, I was introduced to them, and I became friendly with Graham, who was just a super guy. The last time I saw Graham, he'd left the Hollies and went over to America.
That's
and
right.
I was in a club in London in 1968, speakeasy. And Graham came over and said, great to see you. Where have you been? He said, I've been in LA. And he said, come, you're going to meet a great friend of mine. She's come over. And he introduced me to Cass Elliot, Mama Cass.
Oh, yeah. Now you've made me jealous. Now you've made me jealous.
Sitting at a table, I'm sitting with Cass Elliot, Graham Nash, David Bowie, and John Lennon. I felt like the poor relative, you know.
I've got to tell you now.
And Dave Bowie was a sweetie because he was brought up in Bromley and I was brought up in Orpington. And if you ever watch any interviews for David, he really was a nice man, very unassuming.
That's how he came across.
Just a lovely guy. And Cass Elliot, I was a big fan of the Mamas and Papas. And I spent an hour talking to her, an absolute sweetie.
Do you know what? If I could get a time machine, I'd go back to that time, take you with me so you could introduce me to your younger self, and then he could introduce me to Cass Elliot. That would be absolutely amazing.
But funny enough, the two people that people ask me about, they want to know more about, Jimi Hendrix, for one, and Jimmy I met because his manager, Chas Chandler, asked me if I'd go down and when he brought Jimmy over from America.
Yeah.
He told me he got this black guy who played guitar with his teeth, and I thought, well, that's not going far. So I didn't bother going. When I met Jimmy and told him, he almost choked on his spliff laughing. But off stage, Jimmy was very unassuming, quiet almost... he became this other character on stage, but off stage, just a very quiet, very modest.
Yeah.
And the other one everyone wants to know about is Keith Moon. Well, I toured with The Who twice, and obviously drummers used to hang out with Keith, but going out with Keith was like going out with a maniac.
Was it easier going out with 10 Glaswegians than going out with one Keith Moon then?
Well, I mean... Keith, I mean, when I was touring with him, he was on elephant tranquilizer.
Oy.
I don't think I've ever met anyone that consumed so much alcohol and take so much pharmaceuticals and still function. In fact, a night out with Keith would take me a week to recover.
Wow. Wow.
But he was very generous. Keith was, he was a madman.
Yeah.
Probably all the stuff he was taking, but you certainly... He lived up to the legend, and yet he never tried to be a star. He was just Keith.
Yeah,
but everyone knew he was crazy.
He was just a party animal, really, wasn't he?
He was seriously I mean, I remember staying in we were on tour up in Liverpool at the Nelson Hotel, and I'm asleep. It's 4 a.m. and I heard this a load of noise and bangs, and I thought, what the hell? And then the phone rang. And Mr. Whitehead. I went, yes. This is reception here, Mr. Whitehead. We have a Mr. Moon in reception, and he'd like to know if you can come out to play. Please come down. He's letting off fireworks on the hotel lobby.
Oh, dear.
Really true. You know, Keith wouldn't take no for an answer.
I bet. He
said, we're going out, Al. All right, let me get my clothes on.
Oh, that sounds like a great time. So jumping forward to the 21st century then, you're executive producing films. I'd love to get you on another time on my 60s show, because I do a dedicated 60s show, and we can talk about Jimi Hendrix and we can talk about everything else and do a little bit more in depth about the band. But tell me what you're doing now.
I mean, there isn't anyone you can name that I haven't met.
Oh,
had a few drinks with.
I could believe that.
Because we all did meet socially, either at Top of the Pops, or the other big meeting place was the Blue Boar, the Junction, and the M1 and the M6.
Oh, wow. I bet that was a hive of...
On a Saturday night, all the groups would be converging down towards London.
Yeah.
And we'd all go in the Blue Boar, and you'd see them all in there. Oh. And all the clubs, there was like the Speakeasy, the Bag of Nails, the Scotch. They were primarily for music people, so you could socialize with them.
Yeah.
That social atmosphere that we had with the musicians is not there anymore, but it was very much like a sort of very unique club, really. Everyone knew everyone.
I know. We have music jams going on around the area, and that's sort of where all us musicians midweek get together and get up on stage and play with each other, like Michael Ellis. And hello, Michael's listening, by the way. You can say hello if you want. Gordon, Tommy, we all get up and we jam together, and it's nice because normally at the weekend we're all out and about performing in our own little in our own little gigs and our own little world. So, yes.
Well, I spoke to the guys, and, of course, they're all out of work now. The gigs they were doing all been cancelled.
Yeah, I know. Same here. Same here.
I'm lucky because I can work from home and just reading scripts, and I've got two offices at home, so it's not such a big deal, but I'm a social animal. The fact I can't go out and mix, and I've been invited to all sorts of things when I'm working with the film industry,
yeah,
and all of that is stopped now.
We can't do it.
Lucky enough, we finished a loss adjuster. We're just editing, and the editors could do it working from home, but that'll be out in November.
I'll look forward to that.
The next film we had, we put it on hold because there was no film production. You know, Netflix have cancelled everything.
I bet they have.
And the BBC have cancelled certain stuff. So yeah, there's going to be a mass shortage when they start this back up again, because all the film productions have all stopped now.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to look forward to the loss adjuster, because I used to be a loss assessor.
It's the same. That's exactly what it's about. Luke Play is a guy that goes to people's homes when they've had a burglary.
That's it.
To adjust the loss. It's a brilliant story, and Luke told me the script was so good. It's basically one day in his life where, and it's almost a black comedy where he loses everything, his job, his home, his wife, everything in one day.
I'm going to look forward to seeing that, Please God, when it comes out.
And I've got to tell you, this will make people look at Luke in a completely different light, because as you know, most of his films, he plays action, like he was in Hellboy. He played the prince who did all that. He told me he spent 3 months martial art training before he even started filming.
Wow.
And then he was in Blade 2, where he plays the vampire, again, a lot of martial arts.
Yeah.
I mean, he's super fit.
Oh, of course.
He plays a broken salesman, really, an insurance salesman. He's acting. He's a really great actor.
I look forward to seeing that. He is. I must admit to you that he is a very good actor. I've seen him in a lot of stuff, and he does put himself completely into the part, and it's just so believable.
Absolutely,
watching
yeah.
him. Yeah, I know. Well, Alan, thank you for the chat. I've got to go.
Pleasure.
Because we're nearly out of time on this show, but thanks for the chat. We'll do it again on my 60s show, and good luck with reading the scripts, and when all this nonsense clears away, good luck with a new venture in the music as well.
Yeah, you call me anytime you like. Happy to talk about the old days.
Thank you, Alan. You take care. Stay safe. God bless.
And you. All the best.
Bye. Bye-bye.